This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Search for the Red Dragon by James A. Owen. Read by James Langton.
Prologue. It was not the soothing notes of a lullaby that lured the children from their beds, but it was a song nonetheless. Their parents never heard it, for the tune had not been intended for them. It was a song played for children, and when they heard it, the children came. Half asleep and barefoot, still in their nightshirts, the children climbed from their beds and through windows that had been opened unknowingly to let in the cool breezes of evening. They walked, entranced, down winding lanes that converged into a single path that none of them had ever seen before, but that had always been there. It had many names, for it was only ever walked by children, and children have a fondness for naming things. But each child, as they passed, knew it for what it truly was, the road to paradise. They knew this because the song they heard told them so. The notes of the music seemed to emanate from all around them, played everywhere and nowhere all at once, and the music maker, when they glimpsed him in the twilight air, seemed to change shape in time with the music. His flickering, ghost-like form was sometimes a grown-up, and other times a child like themselves. And sometimes he seemed not to be human at all. The music told them his name, the King of Crickets, and none of them could resist the song he played. None, save for one. She had been cautioned that one day the King of Crickets would come, and that unless she was prepared, she would not be able to resist his song. No children could, unless they were crippled and could not follow, or were unable to hear the tune and fall under its spell. The beeswax she put into her ears, as the dream had told her to do, kept out enough of the music for her to resist its lure, but not so completely that she couldn't feel the desire, nor hold back the tears that streamed onto her pillow as she finally slept, still dreaming of paradise. For some children, the path ended at a great mountain face that split open to embrace them and closed as they passed through. For others, it ended at a great precipice which they stepped over willingly because the song told them they could fly. But for most, it led them to the men of iron and the great ships that departed with the dawn. In the light of morning, the path would again vanish, but it would have a new name, the Sorrow Road. As they awoke to find the beds of their sons and daughters empty, the mothers and fathers in the towns and villages would feel bewilderment, then fear, and then terror, and they would name the path with their cries. But it was too late, much, much too late. The children were already gone. Part 1. 9 Years in the Summer Country. Chapter 1. The Angel in the Garden. John rarely dreamed, and it was even more seldom that he could recall what he dreamed about. But as of late, he had had dreams every night, and he remembered them all, because when he dreamed of giants. Massive continents of bone and sinew, creating their own topographies as they strode across the landscapes, giving little notice to the awed creatures watching from below. The giants were so great, it seemed they had both gravity and weightlessness, as if the next thundering step would suddenly launch them into space, to join with the gods and titans among the constellations. Standing with the populace of his dream world, all of whom strangely seemed to be children, John watched in mute wonder as the giants strode past with geological slowness. Then, as in each of the dreams, one of the giants turned and looked down directly at John. Shifting its weight, it bent and reached for him with a hand the size of a barn as the children around him began shrieking. The train whistle was shrill in the afternoon air, startling John out of his troubled reverie. He stood and quickly scanned the crowd departing the train that had just come in from London. The station at Oxford was not large, but the afternoon schedules were always full of both comings and goings, and he didn't want to miss the person for whom he was waiting. He realized, with a rising thrill, that he was far more excited to see his old friend than he'd expected to be. They had, in point of fact, spent only a few weeks together a number of years before, but the events of those days were enough to make them closer than mere colleagues. And so, when the thin, nervous-looking man with the high forehead and round spectacles finally emerged from the train onto the platform, John rushed forward and greeted him like a brother. "Charles!" he exclaimed joyfully. "I say, it's terribly good to see you."
"I'm very pleased to see you too, John," said Charles, clapping his friend on the back. "It's odd. As I got closer and closer to Oxford, I kept feeling as if I was coming home. But it wasn't because of the place, rather because I knew I was going to be seeing you and Jack. Does that sound strange to you?"
"Yes," replied John, chuckling, "but in all the right ways. Come on, let me help you with your bags." As they loaded Charles's belongings into John's vehicle, Charles looked around nervously and leaned closer to his friend.
"I wanted to ask," he said in a conspiratorial whisper, do you have it with you?"
"Of course," said John, pointing to a bundle of books and papers on the rear seat. "It's there, in the middle somewhere." Charles's eyes widened in shock.
"Here? Out in the open?"
he exclaimed.
"Not locked away or anything? John, are you out of your mind? That's...
He lowered his voice again.
"That's the Imaginarium Geographica, the single most valuable book on Earth. Don't you think it's a bit, risky?"
"Not at all," John said with a trace of smugness. "Take a look at the lecture on top of the pile." Charles adjusted his spectacles and peered more closely at the document.
"It says, a proposal for syllabus reform as regards the study of ancient Icelandic. And the rest appear to be notes on courses in comparative philologies."
He climbed into the seat next to John and gave his friend a puzzled look.
"Don't take this the wrong way, but how many people, even at Oxford, would care about such things?"
"Precisely my thinking," said John as he started up the car. "I have a hard enough time getting the undergraduates to pay any attention to Anglo-Saxon, much less old Icelandic. What better protection for the Geographica than to bury it amongst manuscripts that no one else will care about?" It had been 9 years to the day since John and Charles had met each other in London. 9 years since they and the companion they were going to see had gone on the most extraordinary expedition of their lives. Exceptional circumstances had brought the three young men together at the scene of a murder. The dead man, John's mentor, Professor Sigurdsson, had been one of the caretakers of the Imaginarium Geographica. The Geographica was an atlas of maps of a place called the Archipelago of Dreams, a great chain of islands that had been coexisting with our own world since time began and had influenced many of the great men and women of history. But not all of those influenced by the archipelago were influenced for the better. A man called the Winter King tried to use the Geographica and the knowledge found within to conquer the archipelago. Another caretaker, Bert, enlisted John and his two friends to travel into the archipelago to try to stop the Winter King. And somehow, despite terrible odds, they managed to do it. The Winter King lost, and fell to his death over the edge of an endless waterfall. A new order was established in the archipelago under a new king and queen, and the Geographica now had three new caretakers, John, Charles, and the youngest of the three friends, Jack. But there had been prices paid for their victory. Allies were lost, mistakes were made, and although there had been a measure of redemption, there were some events that would never be far from their thoughts. Events in the archipelago resonate with those in our world, which was then still in the midst of World War I. John resumed his service in the military just as Jack began his. Only Charles was spared due to his general nervous nature and age. And when finally the war ended, they all resumed their lives as if the war and their adventure in the archipelago had been imaginary aberrations or dreams. And perhaps John could have convinced himself that it all had been a dream, if it were not for the great leather-bound book that he still possessed. He had not had so much as a message from Bert since the old tatterdemalion had returned them to London aboard the White Dragon, one of the great living dragon ships that were able to cross the boundary between our world and the archipelago. At least, John mused, there hadn't been any more murders, or another war. He didn't think the planet could survive a second war on the scale of the one they'd come through. But then again, much of the responsibility for those events could be attributed to the Winter King, and he had been dealt with. John had been working in his study at Oxford when the messenger boy arrived with the note from Jack's brother Warren that requested he come to see Jack immediately. As he was reading it, the telephone rang. John picked it up and was happily surprised to find Charles on the other end, having just received a telegram of his own. In short order, arrangements were made for Charles to travel to Oxford, where he and John could meet and then go together to see Jack. When they had parted ways in London years earlier, they had made a pact to never contact one another except in the event of a situation arising that involved the care of the Geographica or the archipelago, or in case of another extreme emergency. It was, they decided, the only way to protect the secrets they had been entrusted with. It was likely, if not inevitable, that their academic pursuits would sooner or later bring them into contact with one another, but otherwise it might foster too many questions for the three to be in one another's company. And in 9 years, no occasion had arisen for any of them to cross paths. So for Jack to deliberately break their pact and contact each of them directly was, John suspected, probably more for a bad reason than a good one. Unlikely as it was, he hoped it was the latter. The small cottage where Jack was staying was near a cozy little village at the edge of Oxford City. They parked the car on a patch of gravel just off the road, and after checking on the Geographica, went to the front door and knocked. The door was opened immediately by a thick-set, tanned fellow in military dress, who bore more than a passing resemblance to the young man they both remembered. John and Charles both hesitated before remembering that it was Jack's brother who had summoned them there in the first place. John immediately stiffened into the formal posture he affected when addressing a fellow officer. "You are a captain, I believe," he asked before the other waved off the question.
"Please, we're all informal here," the man said, shaking John's proffered hand. "I'm heading swiftly for retirement in a few more years, and plan to soon be devoting my time to assembling the family papers, and as much reading as I can manage."
"I'm John, and this is Charles. We came as quickly as we could."
"A pleasure," said Charles,
stepping forward to shake the man's hand.
"You're Warren?" "Call me Warney. Jack does. I'm very grateful to both of you for coming, although I must admit it's a bit odd that he should ask for you."
"Why is that?" said Charles.
"As I understand it," Warney explained, "you've not actually become officially acquainted since he began teaching at Magdalen. In fact, before yesterday, Jack never so much as mentioned either of you at all."
It was a testament to the swiftness of their self-control that neither John nor Charles exchanged a glance at this.
"'It's just that Jack is an intensely private person,' Warney continued. "'And while he's an excellent tutor, and is very affable with our circle of friends, "'it's unlike him to be so open about personal matters with the, strangers, so to speak, "'and especially so to invite them here to his private study. No offence.'
"'None taken,' said Charles, trying to keep the mood light. "'If I'd come here for a bit of solitude, I wouldn't want to be disturbed either. This is a lovely accommodation. It's called the Kilns, isn't it?
Yes, it is, said Warney, nodding. After the brick buildings down the way. We've taken it for a few months so that Jack could get some work done, he went on. It's a very pleasant place, actually, and very convenient to Oxford, as you've seen. The gardens are quite large, almost a park, and extremely overgrown. But I wouldn't mind settling here for good. If we had the coin to afford the price.
He regarded Charles appraisingly.
You called it the Kilns. You know Headington Quarry, then?
I have had my opportunities for walking expeditions from the city, replied Charles. Not so much now that I'm based in London, but I do like returning here to Oxford now and again.
I haven't been out this direction yet, John said, but now that I've been given the new position at the university, I expect I'll have plenty of opportunities.
New professor of Anglo-Saxon, Jack said?
Asked Warney. John nodded. Yes, the professors and college tutors don't have too many occasions to socialize, but I imagine we'll be coming together sooner or later.
How is it that you know Jack, if you don't mind my asking?
We met during the war, said John. The three of us, that is. It was a very unusual circumstance. Warney made a dismissive gesture, but smiled knowingly.
"'Say no more. It's all clear to me now. The war created brothers in an instant, and made allies of enemies and vice versa. I was wary that he's asked me to summon colleagues he's never mentioned to me. But if you served together in the war—I didn't mean to pry, but brothers should look out for one another, you understand?'
"'We do,' said Charles. "'That's why we didn't hesitate to answer your summons.'
Warney smiled again.
Good show. Good show. Let me take you back to Jack's study. He's waiting for you there.
You said it was personal matters he wanted to discuss, John said, but it wasn't clear in the telegram you sent what exactly Jack wanted to see us about.
He stopped writing in his journal. Stopped writing altogether, now I think on it, said Warney. Then he stopped reading. That's when I really began to worry.
Why? Asked John.
He lost a very close friend in the war, and although he was nowhere near at the time, Jack feels he is somehow responsible for the fellow's death.
Charles and John each drew a sharp breath. That had to be a factor in why Jack had asked for them. In the battle with the Winter King, he had been responsible for the death of an ally, and it had affected him greatly, but Jack seemed to have reconciled himself to it well before their return to London. Or so they had assumed. Apparently, they were mistaken. "'How is he sleeping?' John asked.
"'He isn't. Night terrors, I'm afraid,' Warney said somberly. "'They've been going on for several days now, and there's been little I could do to help. The worst was two nights ago. Lots of screaming and thrashing about and calling out a word over and over. Avon. I have no idea what it means, and Jack wouldn't speak of it. It was that next morning he told me to seek out the two of you and ask you to come here.
He paused at a sturdy door and hesitated before knocking.
I'll leave the three of you to catch up. I'll be puttering about in the garden if you need anything.
As Warney moved back down the hall, John and Charles opened the door and entered the book-crammed study. Jack, taller, broader, more manlike than the boy they'd known, stood at the window with his back to the door.
Jack?
Charles ventured.
Jack, we've come. It's Charles and John.
Jack tilted his head slightly, acknowledging their presence, but he did not turn around. Instead, he asked a question. Was it real? Did it all really happen after all? It took a moment for them to realize what he was asking. Yes, said John, if you're asking what I think you are. So, the Archipelago of Dreams? The Imaginarium Geographica? Yes, John repeated. It's all real. Jack turned to look at them, his face inscrutable. Do you have the atlas with you? Can I see it?
It's in the back seat of the car, John admitted sheepishly. In a lockbox, or a leather bag, I'd assume.
No, said Charles. It's protected by a thick layer of lectures on ancient Icelandic.
Jack blinked, and then snorted.
And they call you the caretaker principia. Did you at least mix in a few papers on old Anglo-Saxon? Or are you giving your professorship short shrift too?
John and Charles stared at their friend for a moment before the somber expressions on their faces were broken by broad, transcendent smiles.
Of course it happened, my good fellow, said Charles,
clasping Jack by the shoulders.
Our adventure in the archipelago of dreams has become the stuff of legend, and you are one of the heroes.
Jack embraced each of his friends, then stepped back to look at them. Charles, he said with a hint of teasing,
you've gotten old.
Editors don't grow old, Charles retorted. They just become more distinguished.
And you, he said to John, how are you finding teaching at your old stomping grounds?
I like it as much as I expected, said John, although I think I'd prefer to be left alone to write if I have another crop of students like the current bunch, hardly an inquisitive or creative mind among them.
It could be worse, said Charles. You could be teaching at Cambridge.
At the mention of their old joke, the three friends doubled over in laughter. But soon enough a more serious mood settled upon them again, and the haunted look Jack had worn when they entered returned to his face.
Why have you called us, Jack? John asked. What's happened?
It's hard to say, Jack replied. I came up here with Warnie to work on some of my poems, and perhaps a book or three, but several weeks ago I began to have nightmares, and in the last few days they've gotten worse.
Warnie said you called out Avon's name, said Charles.
Yes, admitted Jack, wincing visibly. I've tried not to think much about her since our return to England, but I've been dreaming about her. I think she's in terrible trouble of some kind, but I can't say what. John mused. What else has been in these dreams?
Well, dream stuff, naturally, said Jack.
Things that come bubbling up from one's subconscious. Indians and crows and, strangely, children.
Do tell, John said, considering his own recent dreams.
If there were children, I'm assuming there were also...
Giants,
finished Charles.
If there were children, then there were also giants. I've been having the same dream.
As have I, said John. About the giants, but not about Avon, he said silently to himself. Before any of them could elaborate further, they were interrupted by a knock at the study door.
I'm dreadfully sorry to interrupt, said Warnie, but it seems we've
He paused and bit his lip as a curious and puzzled expression came over his face.
Warn, said Jack, what is it? What's happened?
Oh, nothing bad, I think, Warnie replied. But it appears we have an angel in the garden.
There was indeed, as Warnie had surmised, an angel in the cottage's garden, or at least something that was as close to a description of an angel as one might give if one was unaccustomed to finding such things in one's garden. Sitting in a disarray of just blooming bluebells, mud, and free-floating feathers was a small girl. A small girl with wings. Her face was smudged with dirt, and her clothing, a simple brown tunic, belted at the waist and across the shoulders, was tattered and torn. Her wings were spread out behind her in a manner that was more awkward than graceful, and they were bare in patches where the feathers had detached themselves in an apparently difficult landing.
"More of a cherub, really, don't you think, John?"
said Charles. "And you would know this how?" asked John. "When have you ever seen a cherub?"
"Look," said Charles. "When he said angel, I was expecting something a little more grown up. This cherub can't be more than 5 years old." I'm 8, I'll have you know, the girl piped up. Next Thursday, anyway. And I'm not a cherub or an angel, whatever those are. I'm Laura Glue, and Laura Glue is me. Your name is Glue?
Asked Charles.
Laura Glue, the girl protested. There is a difference, you know.
She stood up and dusted off her clothes, all the while keeping a wary eye on her accidental hosts.
How did you get here? Warnie asked, looking around. Are you with your parents? Or on a school outing, perhaps? This is a private garden, not a picnic spot.
Laura Glue looked at him like he was speaking Swahili.
I flew here, I'll have you know. What do you think the wings are for, anyways?
Jack began examining Laura Glue's wings, and quickly discovered that they were not naturally hers, but were in fact artificial, delicately made of extraordinarily inventive design, but constructs nevertheless.
Hey!
Laura Glue cried, stepping back defensively.
You should ask permission before poking someone's wings, you know.
My apologies, said Jack with a deferential bow.
It's okay, Laura Glue said. Longbeards never ask. I would not have been able to tell, said Charles. From a distance, they looked like they were quite real. Uncle Dedalus makes them for all the lost boys, the girl said proudly. But old Laura Glue's the only one what can fly with them. This far, anyways.
Uncle Dedalus, John exclaimed.
You don't mean to tell me these wings were made for you by the Greek Dedalus of myth, the one who lost his son, Icarus, when the boy flew too close to the sun.
What, are you daft? Said Laura Glue. You'd have to be 1,000 years old.
Exactly, Charles agreed.
You're thinking of Dedalus the Elder, explained Laura Glue. The one what built my wings is Dedalus the Younger.
A descendant? John asked, teasing. Or Icarus's brother, perhaps?
Precisely, said Laura Glue. And the reason he don't use wax anymore when he makes the wings.
All right, stated John. So where were you flying to? Or do you mean to tell us that you planned to crash in Jack's garden?
Planned to crash? No, said the girl. But this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm looking for the caretaker. I got an important message from the archipelago.
John, Jack, and Charles exchanged terse looks with one another at the mention of the title. It could apply to any or all of them, but it most likely meant John. Warnie, of course, had no idea what she meant.
I told you, he repeated, this is a private garden. There is no caretaker.
I'm not looking for a gardener, the little girl retorted. I'm looking for the caretaker of the Imaginarium Geographica.
She rummaged around in her tunic and drew out a delicate flower that seemed to be made of parchment, on which 3 symbols had been carefully rendered. The flower also seemed to be glowing faintly. John recognized the 1st symbol as the seal of the cartographer of lost places, the man who had created the Imaginarium Geographica. The 2nd was the seal of the High King of the Archipelago.
"What's this 3rd mark?" he asked.
"That's what makes it work," replied Laura Glue. "This is a compass rose. The seal of the king gets it through the frontier. The seal of the cartographer tells it where everything is. And the 3rd mark is what lets you find what you're looking for. In this case, the caretaker. The closer I gets, the more it glows. And when I flew over your cottage, it went so bright it blinded me, and I crashed in your bluebells."
So, she continued, marching around them with a determined look on her face,
where are you hiding him anyway?
Look here, Jack, Warnie began.
Perhaps you should go in and put a pot on to boil, Jack suggested. She's obviously a troubled young girl, but I think we can sort it out. Warnie nodded and headed for the cottage at a trot without looking back. John knelt before the girl and noticed that the rose was still glowing, but got no brighter because of his proximity. "I'm the caretaker Principia, Laura Glue," he said gently. "Now, can you tell us what this is all about?" Her reaction wasn't what John expected. The girl's eyes grew wide with surprise, then narrowed in suspicion.
"You're not the caretaker," she exclaimed. "Where is he, and what have you done with him? Tell me now, or I shall be very, very cross."
"But your compass rose is glowing," said John, and I have the Geographica nearby. I am the caretaker. Why would you think I'm not? Because, answered Laura Glue, who had taken a defensive, defiant stance, he called you John, and I know the real caretaker's name is Jamie.
Jamie?
Charles exclaimed, turning to the others.
It's no wonder she doesn't know any of us. She's looking for the last caretaker, the one John replaced. She's looking for Sir James Barry.
Chapter 2. The Reluctant Caretaker. Inside the cottage, it became evident to Warnie that there was something happening among Jack, John, and Charles that didn't include him. So once he had served them all tea, he made the excuses a gentleman makes and cloistered himself in his own study, shutting the door behind him. Jack saw the hurt expression in his brother's eyes and regretted it deeply, but there was simply no way he could begin to explain everything Warnie would want to know and still have time to deal with the matter at hand, namely, Laura Glue. Never mind the fact that she'd mistakenly found them when she believed she was searching for one of the most famous playwrights of the time. The girl sniffed at the tea Jack offered her, then wrinkled her nose in distaste. She allowed Jack to pour her a cupful of cream, which she sipped at dutifully, but she was more interested in the tea biscuits.
"You don't have any little ones, do you?"
she asked.
"What, smaller biscuits?" asked Jack.
"Yup," said Laura Glue. "They're called leprechaun crackers, although I'm pretty sure there ain't any real leprechauns in 'em."
"Really?"
asked Charles with a knowing smirk.
"And how can you be sure?"
"Because," the girl retorted,
"usually you have to smoosh 'em up separate and spread 'em on top."
"Oh," said Charles.
"That's not part of the official recipe in the book, mind you," she continued, "but I added it in myself."
"Laura," Jack began.
"Laura Glue," she reiterated. "Just calling me Laura is just as bad as calling me Glue. My name is my name."
"Very well, Laura Glue. Tell us about the caretaker you came to find. Tell us about Jamie."
"That's about all I knows," the girl admitted. "I've only ever seen him twice myself, and that was before I went to the well. The first time, anyway."
Charles leaned close to John.
"Not possible," he whispered. "She wasn't even born yet when we went to the archipelago, and that was long after Barry had given up being caretaker."
"I knows what I knows," said Laura Glue, "and my ears hear like a fox."
"Well, Charles stammered.
"It's just that you can't have met him."
"Can't to?"
Laura Glue exclaimed, standing and stomping her foot.
"He said I was sweet, and he gave me a kiss. Look,"
she continued, as she fumbled around inside her tunic.
"I still have it."
She held out her hand and showed them her kiss, a small, tarnished silver thimble. "All right, Laura Glue," said John with a placating look at his friends. "We believe you, but you must also believe us. James Barry isn't the caretaker anymore. The Imaginarium Geographica was given to us, and we are the caretakers now. So tell us what you need, and we shall do all that is within our power to help you." Hearing this, Laura Glue slumped back in her chair and deflated like a spent balloon. It was not the reaction they had expected.
"Then I've come too late," she said mournfully. "I've failed. Grandfather will be so unhappy."
"Your grandfather?" said Jack. "It was he who sent you?"
She nodded.
"Yup. And he was sure that Jamie was still the caretaker. So he sent me to find him to help, because he is who he is."
"He is what, Laura Glue?" asked Charles.
"Grandfather's enemy," the girl replied. "There is something happening in the archipelago, something terrible, and Grandfather says that sometimes something is so important that the only ones who can help are your enemies. And he gave me the compass rose and said to fly to the summer country and find his enemy, the caretaker Jamie, and he would come and help us."
"And what was it that Jamie was supposed to do?" John asked. The girl shrugged and sipped her cream.
I don't know. Grandfather said that the message would tell him everything he needed to know. He is, was the caretaker, after all.
What message, my dear? Charles asked.
Oh, the girl exclaimed. I forgot.
She stood at attention, as if preparing to recite a composition in school.
The crusade has begun.
And? Prompted John. Is there more?
That's it, and that's all, said Laura Glue. May I have some more of the big crackers?
The three friends left Laura Glue munching on biscuits and moved into the hallway, where they could discuss the situation with some privacy.
It's an incredible story, said Jack, but there's too much credibility in it to disregard her.
I agree, John said, but I'm at a loss as to what we should do. Obviously, someone there meant for us to do something, but I have no idea what.
She does have that rose, mused Charles. It bears the marks of both the High King and the cartographer. I can't imagine they'd allow just anyone to use them.
I concur, said John. So how should we proceed?
Obviously, Charles said, we should take her to see Barry. He's in London, and colleagues of mine have often pointed out his residence to me. We can deliver her straight to his front door, and then perhaps we'll find out what this is all about.
That sounds like a plan, said Jack. It's time I was out and about for a bit anyway. Excellent, agreed John. This sort of adventure I can handle. A little mystery, a little drama, and it's all wrapped up and done with a quick excursion into London. It was decided that they would have to take John's car into the city. To take the train, especially from the Oxford station, would risk the three of them being seen on non-university business and would engender too many questions that they'd have to make up answers for. And that was before any queries about their keeping company with a small winged girl with a penchant for yammering on about something called the archipelago. John went to make some adjustments to the engine, followed by a very inquisitive Laura Glue, while Jack and Charles made apologies to Warnie about having to leave. Warnie himself had already decided that this was a business he'd rather have no part in, and so nodded in agreement when they presented their plan to go into the city to locate the girl's family.
I call navigation, said Jack, as they walked out to the car.
What does that mean?
Asked Charles.
It means I get the front passenger seat, said Jack. And you have to sit in the back with Laura Glue.
What?
Sputtered Charles.
That's not fair. I came in with John. I get the passenger seat.
What are you two arguing about? John said, wiping his hands on an oilcloth. The car's ready to load if you haven't something more pressing to settle.
We are arguing about the seating arrangement, Charles told him. I wanted to sit in front.
But I called navigation, said Jack.
Well, there you have it, stated John. Can't be helped if he called navigation. Sorry, Charles.
Drat, muttered Charles.
It was fortunate that Laura Glue's wings were artificial, because they would not have to fit in the small cab of the car and still allowed room for any other passengers. It was difficult enough to get them into the boot, and then only with some amount of judicious folding and positioning. Laura Glue was twisting her hair into knots with nervous concern for her wings, until John pointed out that he was putting the Geographica in the boot as well, so she could be assured it was a safe place for them to be. Wings and Atlas secured, Charles and Laura Glue bundled into the cramped back seat, and John and Jack climbed into the front.
Okay, said Laura Glue, pointing at the threadbare seat covers. There's an invisible line down the middle. This side is for girls, and that side is for boys, and you aren't allowed to cross the line.
It's a little close in here for boundaries, Charles noted. What happens if I cross the line?
Laura Glue scowled.
I'll have to cut out your heart and feed it to the fairies.
Charles stared, wide-eyed and speechless, before the girl's face split into a broad grin to indicate that she was teasing him.
You're not exactly a normal little girl, are you?
Asked Charles.
You have a funny-looking mouth, said Laura Glue.
"This is going to be a very long ride," said Charles.
It was actually a shorter ride than they expected, as the weather was good and there were few other vehicles on the road. Traffic became more congested once they arrived in London proper, but Charles's familiarity with the city streets aided with their navigation considerably.
"Ironic, isn't it?" remarked Jack.
"Oh, shut up," Charles said crossly. "Turn left up here, John, then park as close as you can to the house. The shorter the distance we have to walk in public with Laura Glue, the better."
"Hey,"
the girl said,
"why don't you want to walk with me?"
"Because," Charles told her with a teasing smile, "we've decided we like you, and we don't want some shady fellow swooping in when we aren't looking to carry you off."
Instead of the laugh or sarcastic retort he was expecting, Laura Glue's eyes grew wide with fear, and she seemed to shrink back into the recesses of the seat.
"Don't,"
she whispered in a fragile, frightened voice.
"Don't ever tease. Not about that."
Charles hesitated, but Jack saw the look on the girl's face and reached out a hand to her.
"Don't worry," he said reassuringly. "You're with all three caretakers. And do you know that we're not just caretakers of a musty old atlas? We're also caretakers of everything else there is in the entire archipelago of dreams, even little girls named Laura Glue. And as long as you're with us, no one will ever harm you."
Laura Glue blinked back a tear, then took Jack's hand and smiled.
"Okay," she said, "but I still want to find Jamie, just the same."
It was the twilight hour when they finally trooped up the steps and rang the bell at the place Charles directed them to. The stately, well-situated townhouse was brightly lit within, but there was no answer to the bell or to their repeated knocks on the stout mahogany door. "Now what?" John wondered. "He must be out for the evening. Do we wait for him? Or is there another place to look?"
"There may be," said Charles. "Kensington Gardens is just down the way. Perhaps he's inclined to take evening walks there."
"It's certainly worth a stroll," Jack said, "now that we've come this far. I'm just happy to have had reason to leave the kilns."
Both John and Charles had noted the drastic change in Jack's countenance since the unusual apparition had crash-landed in his garden. He looked fully engaged once more, as if the girl were a fulcrum that had levered him out of his melancholy. And as such, neither one of them was inclined to mention their shared dreams again until it seemed necessary to do so. The mystery at hand was more than enough to consume the evening anyway. The gardens were indeed just a short distance away, and the lights of the city were just beginning to twinkle in the fading cobalt light of dusk when they arrived.
"It's a good-sized park," said John. "Where should we begin looking?"
"Where else?" Charles replied. "The statue."
"Of course," said Jack, slapping his forehead.
"The statue.
It was erected for May morning, was it not? I could be drummed out of Magdalen for forgetting that."
"Or worse," said Charles. "They'd make you take up residence at Cambridge."
Set just along one of the walking paths, the tall bronze statue of Sir James Barrie's most famous creation towered over passers-by, who strolled along at a leisurely pace, hardly pausing to glance at the sculpture. Except for one. The small, slight man was barely 5 feet tall, with a moustache and fringes of white hair that stuck out around the edges of his top hat. He stood holding a cane in one hand and a leash attached to an enormous Saint Bernard in the other. He looked at the statue with an expression that might have been construed as fondness or longing, if it were not also for the immense sadness that seemed to lie underneath. Charles, deciding that this was no time for furtiveness, called out to the man from some 20 yards away.
"I say, are you James Barrie? Might we have a word?"
The man's eyes widened in surprise as he saw a cluster of people eagerly rushing toward him, and he quickly pulled down his hat, turned up his collar, and began walking briskly in the opposite direction, dragging the reluctant dog behind him.
"Didn't he hear me?"
Charles said, puzzled.
"Oh, he heard you," Jack said wryly. "You have all the stealth of a wet badger."
In some places, that's a compliment, retorted Charles.
Do shut up, you two, John scolded. He quickened his pace after the swiftly receding forms of Barry and the Saint Bernard.
Wait, John shouted after him. We only want to speak with you.
It's no use, said Charles. We frightened him off.
Laura Glue planted both her feet and flung out her arms.
Jamie, she shouted. Jamie, please don't go.
And abruptly, the man stopped in his tracks. Slowly, he turned around and looked at them. Then, just as slowly, he walked back toward the four companions, his cane tapping gently on the cobblestones, and the dog trailing obediently behind. Several feet away, he stopped and considered them one by one, before finally looking down at Laura Glue.
It's been a very, very long time since anyone has called me Jamie, he said slowly, and it's not something I allow many people to do. So you must tell me, if you can, who you are, and why you call me by that name.
The little girl's eyes began to well up.
Don't you remember me? The last time we met, you gave me a kiss.
She showed him the thimble, and he knelt down in front of her.
My dear, I am an old man, and in all my years, many, many children have seen that play, and they know that a thimble is a kiss, and a kiss is a thimble. And please forgive my aged memory, but I can't have been the one who gave this to you, because I haven't done that sort of thing since long before you were born.
But,
she stammered, confused.
You must be Jamie, otherwise it wouldn't have worked.
What wouldn't have worked, my dear?
This,
said Laura Glue, pulling the compass rose out of her tunic. In the presence of four caretakers, it shone as brightly as a beacon. The expression on Jamie's face changed rapidly from surprise to disbelief to, strangely, gratitude.
Put that away, he said gently,
and let me see your kiss again.
Laura Glue tucked the parchment flower back in a pocket and handed him the thimble. He rumbled as he examined the kiss.
I see it now. I'm sorry I didn't recognize it before. I wasn't expecting anyone like you in Kensington Gardens. Not again, anyway.
He put his arm around the girl and drew her close.
Do you know, this kiss is one of the only items ever removed from the treasure trove of the great dragon Samaranth?
For really and truly? Said Laura Glue.
Yes,
Barry replied, winking at John as he spoke.
It was acquired in an adventure of great peril, and my best friend and I barely escaped with our lives.
Whatever else has gone on, John whispered to Charles, it's obvious why he was chosen as a caretaker.
Yes,
said Charles, nodding. Laura Glue clapped her hands.
I know that story. I know it. That was before you got old again and became his enemy.
A pained expression flashed over Jamie's face before he smiled and kissed Laura Glue on the forehead.
It was the best of my failures, my dear girl. Now, who's for some leprechaun crackers in front of a fire? The sun has set, and it's obvious the fairies are going to be about in Kensington Gardens tonight.
Chapter 3 The Lost Boys. True to his word, back at Jamie's home, he had an ample supply of leprechaun crackers, as well as an assortment of other biscuits, teas, jams, jellies, and chocolate.
I find it useful to be prepared, Jamie said as he settled into an overstuffed chair with a cup of tea, for even the most unexpected of visitors, particularly the youthful ones.
This is wonderful,
mumbled Laura Glue through a mouthful of crackers and chocolate.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome, my dear,
he said as he placed a saucer of cream and crackers on the floor for the great Saint Bernard, who was lounging comfortably before the fire.
Aramis likes treats as well, but that's more often than not just an excuse to indulge in a nipple myself. And now,
Jamie continued, turning to the three men,
can you tell me what's brought three gentlemen and a child of the archipelago to Kensington Gardens, just to have tea with an old playwright?
When they had finished eating to everyone's satisfaction, Laura Glue repeated the message she had been sent to deliver, and, her mission accomplished, promptly busied herself with grooming the dog while the caretakers talked. It took more than an hour for John, Jack, and Charles to recount the events that had brought them together years earlier as the new caretakers, during which time Laura Glue fell fast asleep on the cushions in one of the townhouse's deep bay windows. They continued with a brief accounting of the war with the Winter King, concluding with the afternoon's events and the sudden appearance of the girl with wings. When they had finished, Jamie stared into the fire, considering for several minutes.
"I was terribly sorry about Stellan," he finally said. "I read about his death in the papers, of course, but it never crossed my mind that it had been the work of the Winter King. And the next couple of years, as the war wound down, I suspected that Bert and Jules had taken some sort of action with regard to the archipelago, but I tried to put it out of my mind. When I left, I vowed to be done with it, and for better or worse, I've kept that vow. Until tonight, that is."
"You were Arthur Conan Doyle's replacement, weren't you?"
Charles asked.
"In a manner of speaking," said Jamie. "There have always been three caretakers, more or less, although once called to the task, those who previously served as caretakers never seem to be completely removed from the responsibilities it entails, as you may have noticed," he said, smiling broadly. "Before Jules Verne, I believe it was three Americans who answered the call. Then Jules, then Bert, who was to become the new caretaker principia. Harry Houdini and Doyle were recruited at the same time by Jules," he said. "But they both had the same problem. Neither of them wished to keep the secrets of the archipelago. Houdini, in fact, wished to expose them to the world, and did his best to do so."
"Whew," Charles whistled. "That can't have gone over well with Bert."
"Bert was the least of the worries," said Jamie. "At one point, it had gotten so bad that Samaranth himself had come to England, looking for both Houdini and Doyle, and it wasn't just to take back the Geographica. He'd heard about that business with the photographs and the fairies, which had been brought over on the Green Dragon, incidentally, and he planned to end their tenure definitively."
A shudder passed through John as he recalled watching Samaranth do that very thing in the final battle with the Winter King. When Samaranth was holding him in a claw high above the waterfall at the edge of the world, and after every chance for redemption was given, the evil man still struck out at the great dragon, who subsequently dropped him. John couldn't imagine what it must have taken for Samaranth to go looking for vengeance.
"It's never been confirmed for me by Jules or Bert," Jamie continued, "and Arthur certainly wouldn't speak of it. But some mishap between Doyle and Houdini is what resulted in the Winter King's knowledge of the Geographica."
"You've got to be joking," exclaimed Charles. "How irresponsible can one be?"
"Up until that time, there were objects other than the Geographica that had been entrusted to the caretakers," said Jamie. "And whatever those items were, the Winter King took them and used them to facilitate the construction of a new dragon ship."
"The Black Dragon,"
Jack said with a shudder.
"I know it better than I'd have liked to."
"And that was the reason Doyle and Houdini were removed as caretakers?"
"Mostly. A one reason among many, I'm afraid. Bert was the caretaker principia at the time, so the responsibility was his. He took the brunt of it, but managed to keep Samaranth from killing Houdini and Doyle. Jules returned briefly as the caretaker principia before Bert resumed the post. This was just prior to finding Stellan Sigurdsson, and then, after a succession of brief, late-tenured, well-intentioned replacements, I was finally enlisted as the new third caretaker."
"And then you quit," declared Jack.
"I prefer to say I resigned," Jamie said mildly. "And I do hope that you'll take a more civil tone, Jack."
"Resigned, quit, whatever you call it, you abandoned your duties," Jack shot back.
"Duties I never asked for," Jamie protested. "I didn't want any of that. I wasn't prepared. Arthur wanted it and had it, and then they took it from him and made me take his place. And it terrified me to have that kind of responsibility suddenly thrust upon me. Do you have any idea what that was like?"
"I have every idea of what that was like," said John coolly. "That's precisely what happened to me after you gave it up. But because of what happened with you, Professor Sigurdsson never told me what I was being trained for, or even mentioned the Geographica, until events were in motion. I only got to speak to him that much by stepping into the past, through a door in the Keep of Time, because by then, he'd already been murdered.
"Are you saying that's my fault?" said Jamie. "My fault he died? Bad form, John."
"Maybe," answered John. "Maybe things would have progressed differently if the professor and Bert felt they could be more open and honest with the new caretaker. And maybe he wouldn't have died protecting the Geographica, because it would already have been passed to me."
"But wouldn't the Winter King have simply pursued you, then, John?"
Charles asked reasonably.
"Instead of the professor?"
"There's no way to know what might have happened," said Jack. "All we know is what did happen, and we know that when the time came to stand up like a man, Sir James Barry turned and ran." Jamie's face reddened, and his fist trembled as he rose from his seat.
"Take back that remark, sir, or I shall be obliged on my honour as a gentleman to call you out."
Jack also stood and stepped close. "I'm right here. Say what you have to say. If you want to take a swing at me, feel free to do so."
"Now, now,"
Charles said placatingly as he rose and smoothly edged between the two men.
"This isn't resolving anything, and you two are not going to help Avon by engaging in fisticuffs."
The mention of that name stunned both men into dropping their fists and retaking their seats.
"Avon,"
Jamie said, his voice low.
"What does any of this have to do with Avon? Is she all right?" "I can't say for certain,"
said Charles, looking askance at Jack.
"There are a number of pieces I'm trying to put together, and I don't think any of them are before us by happenstance."
Beginning with Charles's account, and with frequent interruptions from John and Jack, they told Jamie about Avon's role in their great adventure, and about her closeness to both Jack and the young man they called Bug, who eventually became the new High King, Artus.
"So she's become the Queen of Paralon, then, eh?" Jamie said with a wan smile. "This Artus must be quite a fellow to have wooed her away from the sea. I imagine Nemo had quite a bit to say about that."
At the mention of the former captain of the Yellow Dragon, Jack shifted uncomfortably in his chair, and John quickly leaned in. "Where Avon enters into this is the reason we've come together. It seems we've all been dreaming of the archipelago, about strange creatures and events, and Jack summoned us together to discuss their import."
"Dreams are curious things," said Jamie, "but Jack did well to take heed of his. There is always meaning behind them, and it cannot be coincidence that you had the same dreams. Laura Glue's appearance confirms this."
"Agreed," Charles said. "Laura Glue's claim that the archipelago is in trouble and Jack's feeling that Avon may be in peril could be one and the same occurrence."
"And what of the message?" asked John. "What does it mean?"
"The crusade has begun," said Jamie. "It really doesn't say much at all, does it? I must confess, I have no idea what it means, but..."
He paused, then stood and moved to the fire, stoking the embers.
"There's an old myth in the archipelago," he went on softly, shaking his head. "A legend, really. I recall it mentioned a crusade. But those events happened 7 centuries ago. We always thought it was only a story."
"I don't think this is going to be as easily resolved as anyone hoped," Jack said.
"Just so," agreed Jamie, sitting down again. "I think the best thing to do is find out what's happening in the archipelago. Have you contacted them yet?"
"Ah, how exactly do we go about doing that?" asked John. "It's never really come up before."
"You don't say,"
said Jamie with an expression both amused and incredulous.
"You brought the means with you."
He moved to the sleeping child and delicately removed the still glowing parchment flower from her tunic. The others huddled around him as he pointed out what the symbols on the compass rose meant.
"Everyone thinks the seal of the High King is A for Arthur, the first king of Paralon," said Jamie. "But it's really the Greek letter A for Alpha, the beginning."
"And that, there,"
said Charles, pointing at a symbol that resembled an inverted U with a tail.
"The mark of the cartographer. What is it?"
Mew, said John, the equivalent to our M, although I have no idea what it means in relation to the cartographer. Jamie?
Don't look at me. I've wondered about that myself.